Attention, please. Places for top of show. Places for top of show. Hello, and welcome to Twins Talk Theater. We are Cindy.
And Stacy.
And we're talking about theater, backstage life, and all the excitement that the audience doesn't get to see.
Enjoy the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast with Andy Lowe. We still have a little bit of sound recording issues, but the new computer is here and set up, and the next time we record, it'll be ready to go. Andy had a lot of great things to talk about, so this is going to be broken into two podcasts. The first one you will hear today, the next one will come out next Friday. So stay tuned. Hi, today we talked to Andy Lowe. I met him at East West Players. He is the production manager there, and we are working together on Allegiant. But he has been working in theater for years. He started out down in San Diego as a playwright, as a director, as an actor. You said you were an electrician for a while, a set designer.
I was actually an artistic director for like 10 years.
An artistic director and now a production manager. So you've gone through quite a few different things. So how did you get into theater, and did you intend to stay in theater for so long?
You know, actually, I had grown up around theater. All of my sisters were performers, singers, had done choir and musical theater growing up, and my dad loved musical theater, so we kind of grew up around it. But I never really thought, I was much more of a shy kid than the rest of my family, and so I actually thought I was going to go into animation. Or sequential art or something like that. So I was more a visual arts guy. But of course, there's still some crossover in terms of storytelling. So there were scripts mm-hmm. that I had written in high school, kind of playing with various ideas. And my first actual theater thing that I actually did was I kind of channeled a lot of my you know, 90s teenage angst into a play that I wrote my senior year in high school, which was submitted to the California Young Playwrights Project and actually won production. So it was produced in 94 at the Cassius Carter stage at the Old Globe.
Wow.
And so that, you know, so I did that, and it was very much kind of centered around Asian American. I'm Asian American, by the way, for you can't see me. So it was after that experience, it was kind of a thing where, you know, I did that one play was produced. It made a great impact for me and for other Asian Americans who had come and seen it. And it impacted me that, well, that was it, right? In terms of Asian American stories or Asian American representation, there was no outlet. There was no East West Players in San Diego. There was a writer actually, in high school, middle school, it was very hard to find anything Asian American in San Diego.
San Diego's very white.
Yeah.
from the times I've been down there, and our cousins live down there.
Well, the thing is, you know, honestly, there's a very large immigrant population. I mean, at one time, back in the 90s, San Diego had the largest concentration of Filipinos in the world outside of Manila.
Wow.
And most people don't know that, right? Because San Diego is kind of a large, big city that thinks of itself as a small town. So everything's very isolated. So you have the Filipinos up in Mira Mesa in the South Bay. You have the Vietnamese and pocket communities in Linda Vista and City Heights. You have Chinese up in kind of the North County area, you know, and you know, everyone is kind of pocketed and no one kind of sees one another. So, not being able to find any kind of like Asian American writers or anything like at the library or anything, I actually kind of latched onto a lot of Chicano writers. So the works of Luis Valdez were very powerful to me. Josefina Lopez had broken out recently during that time. And a writer named Victor Villasenor actually came and spoke to our class. And I remember he was talking about his book that he had written at that time. I think it was called Rain of Gold or something like that. And, it was this book of him kind of writing about his life and about his experiences kind of starting as a gangbanger. And he went, his family sent him to Mexico, Mexico City, where he saw pyramids and he saw skyscrapers and he saw, you know, Latinos and Mexican people at every socioeconomic, level. And it was mind blowing for him versus what he had grown up with kind of in his childhood here in the States. And he said, like in his speech to us, you know, Someone's got to tell them. Someone's got to tell them that there are pyramids and there are skyscrapers and there's businesses, as well as, you know, families and poor people and whatever. But that people have to know that this is not all we are. And that was something that was very impactful for me. And so that's kind of the thing where I kind of started to shift from, you know, thinking I was going to write comic books or go into animation to theater, because there was something that was so much more immediate. It was something that you could do now. It was something that you could reach an audience directly at that very moment. And my first year in college, I was still an art major and was very dissatisfied with the art department there. And so I ended up in the scenic design class with Ron Ranson, who kind of was, you know, thinking in terms of design aesthetics that told stories. And that really gravitated towards, at the same time, I ended up falling in with some folks to start this theater company, Asian American Repertory Theater. And a lot of things just kind of snowballed. You know, I couldn't get into a scenic design class, so I ended up in a lighting design class with Chris Perry, you know, who won the Tony for Tommy.
Nice. That's a crazy show.
A crazy show, right? And in so many ways revolutionized the whole medium in terms of what commercial theater is, what Broadway is, you know, how the whole lort to commercial Broadway theater works, all of that. But he was, you know, so I had, you know, these mentors over here. Through working with Chris, I ended up working at La Jolla Playhouse as an electrician, and pretty much became a freelancer, you know, kind of supporting my theater habit through that, while I was running a theater company, became kind of a working actor, was training in kung fu. I mean, I look back, I go, God, I was young.
Yes,
I
had
so much
stuff.
Energy. I just had no life, so I was bored.
Yeah, it's why I take on so many jobs. I can't sit at home. Let's just do all the work.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and so that was the thing. So I ended up, I'm a huge Disney nerd, so I always kind of look back on my life with, you know, a quote from Walt Disney, who always said, you know, I was kind of cursed and blessed that I was never actually good at any one thing. I was an okay machinist. I was an okay animator. I was never really good at anything. But what that did was it forced me to dabble in a lot of things. And and that was his strength of being able to kind of bridge between, you know, design, engineering, art, storytelling.
That's a great quote. Yeah.
Yeah.
For theater people and techies especially, nobody does just one thing.
Yeah. I mean, and it's something that's like, I mean, when I look back on my life, it's like, yeah, you know, that's kind of what happened to me. I wasn't a great lighting designer. I mean, I understand color theory. I could tell you how Binkley makes a plot, right? I mean, because I could create his plot for you right here. I could, you know, I have a pretty good handle on story and you know, I'm an avid follower of you know, kind of Joss Whedon and the whole Joseph Campbell model and why, you know, hero stories work. And all of that kind of influences kind of who I became as a director. Because I mean, I think that's my strength in terms of being able to kind of really know, okay, so what are the limitations of the technology and how can we use it to create illusions and not kill everyone?
That's good. Most people like not killing everyone.
Yeah. It's a good skill. It's an important skill. A skill I wish more people
had or used or something.
But okay. I think I started to ramble. But anyways.
No, that's great. So then when did you graduate college?
Actually, I did not.
Yeah, a number of people we know didn't finish school and still, because people are always like, you have to go to school to get a job, and here you're working the same stuff I'm working without a college degree. I have a college degree. She has a master's degree, but none of us are any
different
than the other.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
It's a tricky thing, right? Because I had the weird thing where I almost was going to school to feed what I was actually implementing, right? I mean, I built a theater company when I was 19, right? Mm-hmm. So I was learning nonprofit management and having to, by necessity, learn how basic carpentry skills and, you know, electrics to implement, as well as acting in the show or whatever like that, you know, just because we were doing it. We were already hitting the ground running, and being the only Asian American producer in San Diego at that time, you know, we filled a niche, and we grew quickly. We were also one of the first small companies in San Diego to really take advantage of the internet, because it was in the '90s. It was you know, so email blasts was a huge, you know, boon to us, and having a website that suddenly put us on a national stage, right? I mean, so people were seeing our production photos and thinking we were a lot bigger than we actually were.
Nice.
But it gave us the ability to grow very quickly. Yeah, it was a lot of work.
Yeah, I started the theater right out of college, me and one other guy. But it's, yeah, they don't teach you how to actually do theater and run theater in school.
Well, you know, and even like on the actor side too, right? I mean, you know, it's like you're an Asian American actor, particularly in the 90s, you're already at a disadvantage, right? So you learn very quickly how to game the system, right? You're like, okay, the agents are not going to submit me, so I got to figure out how to submit myself to things, because the agents aren't going to. So, you know, so you make good friends with the agent. You sit there in the office and you say, well, you know what? I mean, you don't have to pay me, but I'm going to sit here and I'm going to help you go through the breakdowns. I'm going to sneak myself into some of the audition, you know, packages that they send out, you know, or you're just checking at that time Backstage West constantly and submitting yourself, right? So, I mean, I was very aggressive, and I knew how to make a resume. I knew, you know, how to make it clean, how to make what I wanted out of my headshots. And a lot of my classmates that were at UCSD and actors also, they didn't know what an agent did. They didn't know how SAG worked. They didn't know. They were like, okay, after I, you know, graduate from UCSD, I'm gonna move to LA and I'm gonna become an actor.
Yeah.
With no understanding kind of the nuts and bolts of it. And it was kind of astounding. It was kind of a wake-up call for me that it was like, it was a good thing that I was practically applying things in so many different levels and ways while I was, because then I could like pick and choose from my college education and my classes of what I really needed, what I was useful in, what was, you know, overly artistic and not actually useful.
Yeah,
did you learn those things? Did you just like learn them as you went? Like, how did you figure out how to do a resume? It's just, you knew you had to figure out something, and so that's what you came up with.
Kinda, yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, particularly, you know, I mean, it was a thing where, you know, when you're an artistic director at 20, and you go to these, you know, funder things or grant things, you know, and you recognize that the scrutiny is high because everyone's looking at you as a kid. So you gotta learn how to catch up or put up a good face, right? So that's why the internet is helpful at that time. But it is kind of a thing where you like, you know, me sitting there in the office with my agent letting me sit there, I can look at everyone's headshot and go, when I pick up this headshot and resume, it's really messy because they didn't chop down the 8.5 by 11 paper to match the 8 by 10 photo.
The headshot, yeah.
That's messy as crap, and it gets stuck on my hands and whatever. So now I know I should always cut down my resume to match the photo.
I never thought about that because I don't submit headshots.
Right.
It's
a small, simple thing, but it just makes it cleaner, and it means it's never going to crinkle. It's never going to get caught up in your hands. You know, also multiple pages of resume. It's like, oh God, I have to flip through all this crap that, you know, and you only know that when you're sitting there, you're working in a casting office or an agent's office, and you're having to deal with, you know, headshot and resume after headshot and resume. That's the only way you figure it out, and you go, what makes this marketable?
Yeah.
Right.
That's very true. When I was working at the Redland Civic Light Opera, when we started the company, it was kind of the same thing. And I learned that the people who would come in to audition or interview and all would be so nervous. And I'm like, why are they nervous? Like, I'm seeing like 30 of you guys today. I got way more stuff to do than your guys' 5-minute, audition. But it was very true. We would definitely look at, you know, this is 2 pages. It's like, oh, I don't have time to flip a page. I'm not going to read a cover letter. There's too many words. I just want to know where you worked and who you worked with. Mm-hmm. And I want your picture to look like you. Because if I later, when I'm like, oh, I really like that one person, and I don't see your picture, then I'm like, well, I don't remember who that person was. Little things like that you don't know notice when you're sitting on the other side.
Yeah.
But when you're on this side trying to cast somebody or trying to hire somebody, they really stick out.
Actually, this is like one of my big pieces of advice for every actor that, you know, I encounter and they ask me for advice. I'm like, you know what? I mean, it sounds like I'm pandering for volunteer labor, but really spend a day with me and volunteer to run a casting.
Yeah.
Because you will, you know, I mean, I think a lot of actors put so much on, you know, their audition is like their big moment to shine. And when you see it in context, you go, you know what? Everyone's seeing like 100 people a day. It is so easy. You know, it's not you, because there's so many talented people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't matter what you did or didn't do. It's not like you did something wrong.
Yeah, it's right? Not that you did a bad audition. It just that's you didn't not fit, the right thing for the part.
It's that. You might be right for the part, but it's really right for the part as the director sees it, which means it's a very personal vision. So it's not anything personal. It's not, you know, you could kill the role, but it's just not what the director's seeing. So it's it takes the pressure off of things, I think it does.
Yeah, I would agree. Not that I've been an actor, but we just cast not long ago at the Norris Picasso at Lupino Gio.
Mm.
And fun there play. Were... Huh?
Fun play.
Great, love it. I was so excited when we agreed to do it. But the director has a very specific vision, but also everybody knows what Einstein looks like.
Mm.
I'm sorry, he can't be anything but a white German-looking guy.
Right.
Because he's Einstein, and Picasso is Spanish.
Unless you're a director who has a very specific vision.
Yeah, but then you kind of have to play to that he's a different race or a different color.
Mm-hmm.
But Picasso is Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
We needed someone who had darker skin. He couldn't be white and blonde hair. So some people were excellent at it, but we just couldn't cast them because it didn't fit the vision, or it didn't fit, you know, the chemistry. Some of the characters are dating each other. So you had to play them with each other. And if there was no chemistry and you didn't buy that they've been dating for years, then it just doesn't work. And it's not that they are bad actors. It just didn't work for that specific play.
I would counter that it really is still about that director's vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, you can still, you know, honestly, so I'm also the casting director for East Coast Players.
And he has lots of titles.
Jobs. But actually, we just actually got a casting referral request from another company in LA. And they have a very interesting concept for, they want to do Streetcar.
Okay.
They got approval from the estate to do this. And the idea that their concept is that, you know, but it's Blanche, right? Blanche.
Yeah.
Is very much the Southern Belle that we all kind of expect, you know, the aging beauty who's kind of losing her, you know, the height of her.
Yeah, of the her sex appeal.
Sex appeal and all that.
Do whatever.
But, and is played, you know, in period, in accent, and everything else. And everyone else, all the other characters, are played contemporarily. So the whole cast is all diverse. So this is why they called us, because, like, they need an Asian actor for one of the roles. But they kind of, in picturing him as kind of, you know, what is the modern American, you know, aesthetic that this character represents.
Interesting.
So that it's not just her being left behind, but it's literally a mindset being left behind.
An entire,
which
way
is,
of thinking
which is,
and error.
And which is a fascinating way to approach the script. And really, you know, I personally have no need to see Streetcar Named Desire again.
Yeah.
Ever again.
But this is really interesting. And I will probably see this one. So
yeah, it's very cool to see when people do something different and unique,
mm-hmm.
which I think is I haven't seen anything, unfortunately, at East West Players. Mm-hmm. I've followed your page and had friends who worked there and all that. And you guys do a lot of very unique stuff, very new stuff, very different. Obviously, it's a very Asian American heavy
mm-hmm.
culture, but you don't just do Asian American shows, and you just don't cast the same people over and over. So,
well, it's a tricky thing, right? Because I mean, so we, you know, we're in our 52nd year. We were founded by Mako. If anyone if you remember, like, okay, the easiest, lowest hanging fruit is Mako was the voice of General Iroh from Last Airbender.
Yeah.
You know, he talks like this, and you know, but
sorry, Twin, it's a nerdy thing. You won't get it.
Sorry. he was also on Broadway. He originated the reciter for Pacific Overtures by Stephen Sondheim. But so you know, kind of the legacy of this company is giving opportunity to actors who never had an opportunity, right? I mean, this is kind of the thing, kind of going back to casting things, right? I mean, when you look at the resumes that I can get in for the musicals, right? We'll have, for Allegiance, right? We got a lot of submissions for white female actresses for the female lead romantic interest. You look at the resumes from the most experienced Equity actress to the least experienced, you know, non-Equity, you know, community theater person, you see just like 30 some credits running the gamut from, you know, Singing in the Rain to 42nd Street to, you know, Les Mis to, you know, just like the entire canon of musical theater. Then you bring in like the African-American resume, still maybe about 30 credits. And it's Lion King, Smoke and Joe's Cafe.
Once
on this island.
That's about it.
And you know, so it's the same, like maybe 10 shows repeated over and over again, between various, you know, national tours and community theater and whatever. And then you get to the Asian American resume, and you're looking at maybe at most 10, 15 credits. And it's Miss Saigon, King and I, Miss Saigon. And so just so even the opportunity to get the stage time to be taken seriously enough that someone's going to look at your resume and bring you in, it's like, it's just the opportunity's not even there. So it's already stacked. And then you look at like, you know, a contemporary musical cast and you go, well, yeah, of course there's only one Asian couple in the chorus. And that's the only opportunity that they have because their resumes just aren't showing anything because there's nothing for them to audition for. So East West Players is kind of very cognitive of this, right? You know, we just did a production Next to Normal, and it was fascinating. You know, we had Dee Dee Magno Hall. Some people might know her as the voice of Pearl in Steven Universe.
Okay.
And we approached her about the show, and she's like, "We saw you didn't submit for this. Did you want to be considered?" And she was like, "You know, I never even thought about that show because I never even thought of myself in that role." Which is unfortunate. This is kind of the, you know, the self-fulfilling prophecy of you know how this works out, where it's like, you know, she didn't even think of herself as being right for this role, but there's no reason why she shouldn't think of herself as an American mother dealing with mental illness, right?
Yeah, because that's not mental illness, and American is not solely white.
Yeah. And
great if mental illness was stuck to one group, but nope, it's everywhere.
And it's also brought in all these levels in terms of there are kind of to bring the specificness to the storytelling in terms of how mental illness is very taboo in some Asian American communities as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not talked about, right? So being able to kind of, you know, open up that dialogue with an Asian American community and then also kind of represent that this is, you know, this is a human experience. You can have a mixed race Asian American family, you know, that shares this kind of universal experience and is also still very specific in those little ways where it's like the family dinner has pancit, you know?
Yeah, why not?
So 52 years of shows, you know, working on developing new writers, a lot of new works, as well as, you know, we've done quite a bit of the canon. We're well known for doing quite a bit of the Sondheim canon, for the sole purpose of showing that Asians can sing Sondheim, because that was, you know, when Tim Dang back in the day was artistic director, that was something that someone said to him. It's like, oh, I don't believe Asians can sing Sondheim. So
why can't they?
Right. And it's, you know, and
you guys have different vocal cords. You can't sing the same notes. It's on their rights.
Well, we only sing in minor scales.
And there's always big drums around.
Yeah, it's the only thing
you guys can do.
But so it's very cool to kind of be part of this company that has basically been the spear tip of this movement since the 60s. And particularly in the time that we are now, where the conversation in terms of diversity is changing.
And the fact that there's starting to be more of a conversation.
Exactly. Right. Right. I mean, it is a thing where, I mean, you have, you know, it's no joke now, right? You have like three touring companies of Hamilton running around the country. One of them has a half Asian Hamilton who was our Tommy Walker for the Who's Tommy a couple years back, and that company also has an Asian American George Washington, Marcus Choi, who was a choreographer for Beijing Spring, which we did a few years back, and was also the leading player in Pippin for us. Yeah, and like, in, you know, it was like, and first of all, yeah, when I heard about that, that was like, first I was like, oh, it's cool, that's Marcus is in Hamilton, and then I'm like, an Asian American George Washington.
Yeah, but everybody that's in the like, original Hamilton is African American, aren't they?
It's mixed. Actually.
It's mixed.
I mean, for that matter, I mean, Eliza was half Chinese.
Yeah, so I think that's bringing a lot more to the forefront that's made it on Broadway and made it so big. And they're not all white males,
right?
Which is what they were in history, but that's not how they did it in this show.
I mean, it's also we have this initiative that we kind of unveiled a few years back called the 2042 Initiative. And 2042 is the year that the United States Census named as being the year when this country's demographics will shift, where we will be a minority-majority country. 51% of the nation will be people of color or mixed race. That's coming. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, well, who knows if the census still exists in the way that it's supposed to by that time. I mean, that, you know, and that's probably intentional, but still, I mean, just the demographics of the country are shifting. And so that, you know, I mean, you can already see it in television has figured it out. I mean, the market is not the same. And when you've been developing content for a very homogenous audience for, you know, the last, you know, 100 years of programming, then, you know, there's a lot of catching up to do. So no wonder, like, you know, television is seeing declines. Films and theaters are seeing declines, right? Because when everything is streaming, and like these next generations are going to YouTube because they can find content that reflects them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's going to be the scramble where like we haven't been developing Asian American stars. When we get to that point where we really need them, then if we haven't been developing them, then where do they come from? Right?
Yeah, we watch. Even though Kai and I are both white, we have a very heavy Japanese influence around. We eat a lot of sushi and sake and watch anime and stuff. But most of our cartoons, we watched Rebels, which is an American one, and Airbender, which is American. But most of the cartoons we watch are all dubbed over from Japan.
Yeah.
Because it's a very different style than we have out here.
I mean, Airbender is actually a great example in terms of, I mean, still American Caucasian writers, but were deeply rooted in their kung fu martial arts training and I love that show because to me it's kind of, it does for Asian mythology what Tolkien did for, you know, Nordic and Druidic mythology in terms of creating this amalgam world. And it's very, I mean, the magic and the mysticism is all very tightly wound and respectful of the source material that they drew from.
Mm-hmm.
And
really good stories
Stories. I mean, there are a lot of really just like completely direct references to Chinese and Japanese mythology. So like there's a whole there's an episode that's like the moon goddess that Sokka falls in love with. That's a direct pull from Chinese mythology. There's a whole, like, you know, moon festival holiday that story is integral in terms of how you celebrate moon festival in Chinese culture. So, you know, so the way that kind of, you know, shows up in things in that show, which is very wonderful.
Honestly. Yeah, which I think is great because now the American kids watching it, mm-hmm. and it's not in a different language or anything. It's very common to us to, you know, nothing looks foreign, so right. no one's scared away by it. It's still getting some of that culture and that feeling and that different angle of things.
There's nothing foreign about it, right?
Yeah, it's not still... dubbed. It's not. It's very American drawn and not the, you know, anime drawn, which some people are afraid of anyway. So it works very nicely. Yeah. So
I have a question. Have you noticed, I don't know how long you've been at East West Players, but you mentioned when you first started theater that in San Diego that there really wasn't an Asian American, not community, but just a place
presence,
that produced that theater. Yeah, have you noticed in the years since then, have there been more of awareness? Are there more theaters that are producing Asian American work, or have you noticed a change at all in the years, or is it still pretty new?
In San Diego, unfortunately, no. you know, and this was kind of one of those kind of when I made the decision that it was time for me to leave San Diego, it was bittersweet and frustrating because there was no way to do the work that was important to me and serve my city. You know, because, you know, I'm a San Diego, you know, townie at heart. But it just wasn't, there was no financial sustainable model. I was an artistic director for 10 years. I directed a number of shows. I had produced a number of shows as a gun for hire producer. I worked as an electrician. I'd worked at, you know, La Jolla Playhouse. I'd worked at small, tiny theater companies that I had built. But I could not figure out how to get hired as a director, honestly. Everything I had ever done was something that was self-produced. And, you know, when companies come to me with readings and they're giving me a script that is like a Chinese historical drama, that, you know, that's like written in like Hallmark card, my heart is as weighty as a lotus blossom. It's just like, so it's like, and it's like, those were the scripts that people would come to me with. And I'm just like, you know,
it's not really what,
I mean, I did a lot of Asian American theater, but those, like, if you look at the plays we did, it's like, you know, this was very much about contemporary American experience in life, and or you know, there'd be, you know, immigrant stories and adjustment stories, but, you know, I was getting all these historical dramas where they went because, like, you know, I do a lot of puppet work and stuff too, and so it's like, oh yeah, it's exotic, it's like, you know, bring you know, all this theatricality to, it's like,
just playing into an old stereotype. Yeah. Let's do something different.
And so, yeah, so it's like, it is. It's like, and no one intends to be, I mean, racist or whatever. It's like, but there is. There's just, you know, I look, you know, I mean, we, as, you know, as theater artists, we all kind of think of ourselves, you got to kind of think of yourself as, you are a business in and of yourself. You have a brand. I have a brand. And it has nothing to do with necessarily, you know, the work, my output. It starts just from the name itself. And so moving to LA was coming to a place. I mean, honestly, it's like, you know, in LA, like, you know, you have East West Players, you have Little Tokyo, which is, you know, Little Tokyo is where East West Players is located, but like that whole district. You know, you have Cold Tofu, which is the longest running Asian American comedy and improv group in the nation. You have Tuesday Night Cafe, which is the longest running Asian American open mic. You have the theater that we're producing in, producing Allegiance in, which is the JACCC, which is the largest Asian American run venue in the nation at 800 seats.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice venue.
You know, in you know, LA has the legacy of being home to Lodestone Theater, which did new works for 10 years. There's still Artists at Play, which does stuff around town. You know, the whole Asian as Fuck movement that's been running at the UCB and has sprouted into Asian as Fuck comedy shows in LA, San Francisco, and New York.
Huh, I haven't heard about that one.
Yeah, so I mean, so there's really this. I mean, it really is. I mean, LA is kind of, to me, it's very much the epicenter. It's always been kind of the epicenter for Asian American entertainment and representation in the entertainment industry. So it's just a bigger palette. There's more going on, and there's more opportunity. There's more audience, honestly, that I think is open to. I mean, you know, it's you know, this was the funny thing. You know, growing up in San Diego, working up in like La Jolla and the Globe and whatever like that. But when I first moved to LA, within the first month, I started to notice that my sense of humor was somewhat irrelevant because I was so used to, it's like the fat kid who makes the fat kid joke first,
uh-huh.
Right? So all of my humor was focused around being the one Asian.
It's like, ooh, we had to throw in one person of non-white descent. Well,
but it's like, you know, but it's like, I mean, that was also like, you know, high school growing up. I was like one Asian kid and then the small handful of Vietnamese refugees, you know, in our whole 200, you know, graduating class, you know, so it's like, that's the space that I've been navigating, you know, for much of my life. And so then suddenly where I'm working in Little Tokyo, I live in Chinatown, I'm in LA, that is a city that is, you know, 47% Latino. I mean, it's a much more diverse city. Mm-hmm. And like 50% of my sense of humor is now completely irrelevant because it's not like I have to apologize for being me.
Yeah, because there's so many. I mean, we go to Little Tokyo and Kai and I are like the only white people around.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, you know what sake is? I'm like, yeah, I know what sake is. Why do you think we came to Little Tokyo?
But no, yeah, it was an interesting reboot for my brain a little bit.
Was that stressful for you, or was it kind of relaxing? Was it kind of like you could let your guard down, or was it like, oh my God, I have to change my whole mindset now?
A little bit of both, honestly. I mean, because it is relaxing. You know, I'm sorry, okay, I often tell the story of founding our theater company back in the 90s, our Asian American theater company. And it was a bunch of Asian American kids who grew up in predominantly white neighborhoods. And when we found each other and we were working in theater together, there was this sudden sigh of relief because we didn't have to explain sushi to anybody.
Yeah, they already knew it.
Yeah, we didn't have to teach anyone how to use chopsticks or anything. It's like, and those are the subtle things. Like, none of these things are bad things. It's like, you know, I love taking my non-Asian friends to dim sum and, you know, eating the chicken foot just to freak them out.
Yeah, but,
you
know, I'd be freaked out.
But it's fun. But there is a whole other thing of, you know, what they're calling like safe spaces now, right? Where it just there's this unspoken pressure that, you know, is just there. And when that and there's a relief to that, you know. But it also is a kind of a thing where it's like it does add a certain point where I do have to kind of reach, yeah, like a pressure where it's like I have to rejig my brain and also reevaluate contextually, right. How I see myself, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So did you start at East West Players right away? Like you moved up there and that was your first job in LA? Or
actually, yeah. Actually, I moved up here for the job.
Great.
So it was all very fast. Yeah, actually,
Peter usually is.
Yeah. Well, no, I had a 2-day overlap with my predecessor, so it was 2 days to learn. Hey, you're doing 8 jobs.
Yeah, because you guys also have your own space,
mm-hmm.
and you rent it out, and you do shows there, and you have a shop, and you work at other places. So it's very much a
It's a mid-sized theater. It's interesting because, you know, in LA theater, it's actually very rare for 99 seat companies to move up to the mid-size level.
Yeah, they're changing contracts and the way they work with actors and everything.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, because there was no real plan. You know, they created the 99 seat plan back in the day, but there was no methodology or logic in terms of you started a 99 seat plan to grow to a mid-size level. There was no kind of interim plan of how you mentor or build up companies to do that. So East West Players kind of just did it. Back in you know, the late 90s, they just did it. And you know, it's arguable whether or not the operation ever really caught up.
Yeah.
Just because of scarcity of funding, and of course funding is never getting any better in this business.
No.
So to a certain degree, you know, there's growth and then there's scarcity, and both increase together.
Yeah, it costs more to put on bigger shows, yeah. But we don't, and we've talked about this, Cindy and I, in America, there's just no money in the arts.
Yeah.
The government doesn't do it. A lot of other countries do, but America does it. And the newer generation doesn't have the money to, you know, throw down $1 million to name a building for a theater or something. So it's, well, a lot harder to find all the money.
I mean, and going back to college life skills that they should be teaching in theater programs, everyone should be taking a grant writing class.
Yeah, it's like stupid. Not even offered in my...
All of these conservatory programs, like, you should be offering a grant writing program. You should be offering a, what do the unions do and how do I make a resume?
How do you, read their contracts?
Social media marketing should be a required class, for all levels, for design, for actors, because you're going to end up doing it all. I mean, you have to, if you want to do it. It's like, none of us are doing it for the money. So which means you've got to be a bit of a jack of all trades to do it.
Absolutely. When I was applying to grad schools, they wanted portfolios. And I was like, okay, what's a portfolio? And how do I build one? And what does it look like? And what's the layout? And what, how big is it? And just the small things of how many pages and what does it look like? Like, I don't know, because they didn't teach it in school. And so then luckily I had the internet and I went online. But as a TD, you don't necessarily always have stuff to show. And I know Cindy had that issue as a stage manager. It's like, what do I send you, my prompt book? Like, what do I show to show I know how to do things? And there's so many ways to write a resume, but the resume for theater people are not the same as a resume for, a desk job or something. And so how do you do that? And how do you submit that stuff? And I can't send a whole portfolio, but that was before it was easy to just build your own webpage. Now we have webpages, but only within the last year or two did Cindy and I get webpages. And even then it was like, how do you format this webpage? And we had to look at other people's webpages to figure out how to format it. And they don't teach you any of that.
Yeah.
And I never had to worry about a contract. I never had to worry about scheduling anything. It just wasn't taught in school. Everything I've learned has been on the job experience. So I think the school systems need to catch up on, they don't just teach you, okay, here's how you act. It's like, great, but how do I get that acting job? Or how do I get that design job?
The realities of the business of the business.
Exactly. Or I took a bunch of business classes as a business minor, but they taught me how to walk into a multi-million dollar company and just do a job. It's like, yeah, but how do you start the company? And how do you work in a nonprofit that's not a multi-million dollar company? And how do you create a budget when you don't know what you're doing? None of that's taught.
Which is, and so that was the thing, right? Like, I ended up being self-taught in almost all of it, right? I mean, just because it was by necessity. I was building a theater company. It's like, well, I got to figure out how to make a budget. I remember there was actually that circle of friends that we started this company with. To this day, we still joke about, I wish we need to figure out a way to keep track of the money that comes in and like how many tickets sold so that it matches up with how many seats we have. And someone was like, you mean tickets? And I was like, that's brilliant. We should make tickets. So we invented tickets. It was like the stupidest conversation ever.
But it's just one of those things you're like, oh, yeah, somebody already thought about that. They just didn't tell everybody else. And now we have to refigure it out over and over and over again. Yeah, it's amazing that, so many things have to be learned on the job. And I think, Cindy went to grad school and I didn't. But I think I learned just as much by starting a theater company. And she sent me paperwork she learned in school. But most of what she learned, too, was actually doing the shows in school, not actually sitting in all the classes. So. Yeah. It's a very hands-on field to learn things.
Where did you go to grad school?
College Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati.
Oh, cool.
So, I mean, I went because I knew that I wanted a big-scale university with big-scale productions. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily go for the classes, and I'm glad because there really weren't many classes. Their graduate program, at least at the time, they take undergraduate classes and just change the numbers. And so you're with undergrads. So, but I got what I went for. I was able to do Bohème with a cast of about 70 people, including 20 children and a crew of 30, and I was able to do Little Women that had, fully automated sets. And I was able to do these huge scale productions and get that experience, which is what I really wanted. Yeah. But it definitely wasn't a a classroom kind of thing. And at the same time, CCM's one of the top schools in the nation for theater, for musical theater and even tech production. But even then, you know, we maybe had like one lesson in one class that talked about resumes. And, you know, we would have like one or two lessons that talked about unions. And I remember we had one 1.5 hour lesson where we like went over the peak contract with Equity, because most CCM grads go straight to Broadway, you know, but you're like, but what if I don't go to Broadway? Or what if I join AGMA, which isn't an Equity, you know, but it didn't teach all that stuff, you know, and that was from one of the top universities in the nation. So it was, yeah, you just kind of learn it as you go. But
it's always interesting to me because, you know, I mean, I thought a lot about grad school as well, right? It's like, do I actually put the energy to do the one stats class that I'm missing to finish the degree so I can do grad school, right? Because particularly as a director, right? And it's like, you know, I've had other friends, you know, talk to me like they really want to do the grad school route. And I'm always kind of like, do you understand why you want to go to grad school?
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of times it's like, no, because I'm going to do the work. I'm going to concentrate. I want to work with this. Like, no, that's not why you want to go to grad school. You want to go to grad school because you want to build the resume, build the portfolio, and meet your future employers.
Right? Meeting people, I think, is the big one.
Mm-hmm.
Because now Cindy, if she tells people she went to CCM, most anyone else who went to CCM is like, oh, we have a connection. Great.
Yeah.
But it's mostly that connections mm-hmm. that get you places and not so much exactly what you learned there.
Well, yeah,
and it's an expensive thing to do to meet people.
I mean, it's also, sorry, you were going to say something?
No, it's true.
She's still paying on student loans. So, yeah.
I finished, but only because I married well.
Well done. Because I was working at La Jolla and, you know, UCSD for all those years. And it was kind of a thing where you go through and you go, you know, UCC would tout itself, or even the Globe program would tout itself as having such a highly ranked grad program for acting or for the theater department. And I'm like, you know, it's the ranking is really coming because everyone is doing a residency at La Jolla Playhouse, right?
Right.
So in terms of the placement, yeah, all of the LDs coming out of that program are getting the chance to assist for Jim Ingalls and Hal Binkley and Don Holder. And sometimes they'll get taken to New York with them. Or if they move to New York, they've already sat there with Don and know his paperwork and know his plot style and everything.
Yeah, which gives you a leading advantage.
And so then you have that placement, right? I mean, so there's that, or all the actors who, you know, they have to do their residency. So they're going to be in one professional production at the La Jolla Playhouse, right? Which could be a show that is a pre-Broadway run,
mm-hmm.
you know, or is, you know, a post-Broadway, you know, first leg of a tour or a regional tour, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Globe and those two places are known that if you get in there, mm-hmm. first of all, it's really hard to get in there unless yeah. you come from San Diego. And if you get in there, you're basically set. So yeah. wherever you go, and you probably are going to Broadway.
Actually, it's actually hard to get in if you're from San Diego, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because it's you know, I mean, you know how like LA has its whole thing of, oh, if you want to work in theater in LA, you have to come from New York. Well, actually, in San Diego, it's like, if you want to work in San Diego, oh, you have to be from LA or New York.
Oh, weird. We always like going, you had to go to school down there to get into any of those places.
Well, see, that's the only other way. You have to go to school.
So yeah, you have to go to the program, school there.
Then you, but other than that, then it's like, because it's still the thing where, you know, honestly, the whole industry is still like the inertia comes from New York commercial producers, right? So it's Dodgers, it's Niederlander, it's Disney Theatrical, it's all of those cats who, and so then it's like, you know, you have like a La Jolla Playhouse with Globe or Center Theater Group who is like, hey, commercial producers, Disney Theatrical, give us your money and we will, you know, develop your Broadway bound musical
mm-hmm.
and you don't have to play local one rates. Right. So now you can get more scenery than you really can afford in New York because you're building it, you know, in Los Angeles, or you're building it in San Diego with those shops. Right. And you can develop these shows that eventually are Broadway bound. And therefore, it's cheaper to go, I'm going to hire all these actors from New York and then I don't have to pay for the relocation. It's cheaper to put them up for the 2 months of production in San Diego for that workshop than it is to have to hire an actor in San Diego and pay to relocate them to New York.
Yeah, because a Broadway run could last a long time or it could last no time, but the pre-show stuff and the rehearsals and previews and all is a set amount of time.
Yeah.
Interesting. So well, Twin, you should get a job out here and then go back to New York since you're having a hard time finding a job in the city to start with.
Well, yeah. But well, what I was saying about, you're saying the connection between San Diego and La Jolla Playhouse and the Globe. I don't think I would be where I am. I mean, I know for certain I wouldn't be where I am now doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't the connection that CCM has with Cincinnati Opera. You know, almost everybody who works at Cincinnati Opera came from CCM. Almost all the chorus are CCM people, stage management, all CCM people, all the interns. And so that summer between my 2 years in grad school, naturally, I went to Cincinnati Opera. And it was there that I did Nixon in China, which then took me to, you know, that Stacey found for me in Long Beach Opera. And then I've been doing opera for the last 12 years. But it's because of that connection that that university has with that professional theater, you know, that that most other people wouldn't have gotten if they didn't go to grad school.
Yeah.
So, that grad school.
You definitely wouldn't have done Nixon in China in Long Beach if you hadn't have already done it before. Because that was a big draw when Darlene hired you, is that you already knew the show.
Right. And then it was Long Beach that, you know, I was with Long Beach for 6 seasons and they're the ones that kind of got me everything else. So, you know, if it wasn't that school connection, and I didn't even know that at the time when I went to CCM, I mean, opera was completely off my radar. I went for musical theater. And so it's just kind of funny, that connection. And again, that's something that you don't necessarily learn in undergrad. Yeah. You know, that was not something that ever came up in undergrad. That an advantage to CCM is this, or an advantage to going to UCLA or UC San Diego, or even schools in New York City, that is the advantage, is the connection they have with those theaters, which would also be an awesome class because that's how you promote yourself. But
it's, you know, it is interesting kind of looking back on how much I learned in non
what's classrooms.
Well, yeah, I mean, not in the classroom, but also in non-traditional ways, right? Like, honestly, I would say, like, I mean, I had some great directing professors. You know, Andre Belgrader was amazing, and one of my mentors, but I feel like a lot of what I know about directing, what I know about staging and storytelling, comes from being a deck electrician or a follow spot. On really bad La Jolla shows. Well, some of the good ones too. But like, you know, but you see these famous directors or, you know, high level directors being forced to do really dumb shows because commercial producers give them money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just like awful shows. And watching them try to navigate, well, okay, we know it's a dumb show. But there's all this money and people are invested in it. So how do we make all the bells and whistles, you know,
make it mask? So people will come see it.
Yeah. And right. I mean, that's like, and this is something that, you know, people kind of make fun of Broadway about a little bit now, is that it's like, you know, I always joke, like, there's some shows that you see where you can tell it's like the director really didn't want to spend any time dealing with blocking the actors. So they just asked for a set that would move them around for them. Right? Just sing. You sing. We'll move you around. We'll make you fly, put a revolve, put you on a skateboard.
You see that when they bring in named people.
Yeah.
You know, I forget what show Matt and I saw last year, but it was somebody who is not a musical theater person, but has a big name because they came from movies, you know, and they pretty much, every time they're on stage, they just like stood there and sang, and everyone did stuff around them. So if you weren't looking very closely, it looked really awesome. And I'm like, that person never picked up their foot. They never moved a prop. They never interacted with anybody. You know, because, but you want that big name that draws all these crowds in, you know, but you just have, every, like you said, you have the set move around them. You have everybody else move around them. So they don't have to do anything.
But it's like, you start to really see like how staging can work, right? And then, and honestly, it works a lot like, to bring it back, it works a lot like a comic book panel, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, what is the, you know, if I'm sitting looking at the proscenium, you know, what is the strongest point on that stage? What's going to be center? It's what's going to be stronger than that, higher than center, right? If I watch someone moving from left to right, they're going to be making, you know, a positive movement. If they're moving from right to left, they're doing something negative, right? And these are all concepts that are true in comics, and you can see, like, you know, great comic book artists that understand storytelling and understand how you can create time and presence and power dynamics just from placement and frame, and all of it still applies to staging.
Well, the same as the set or the lights or anything. You know, if the set is very symmetric and very even on both sides, it's probably a lighthearted comedy. If the set is very asymmetric and things are off and it's, you know, there's hard angles and stuff like that, it's probably not a comedy. It's probably more of a drama.
Because
comedies are safe and balanced and everything like that. And dramas are very off-balance and off-kiltered. And, you know, the keys to the music aren't... they're all in minor key and they switch tempos and all that. So right there, it's giving you a sense of what's going on. But as a person just watching it, if you're not paying attention to that, you still understand that, even if it's not a conscious understanding. Like Evita, her main song, she's standing on a platform, center stage, spotlight.
Yeah.
Right there, you know exactly who the lead of the show is.
Where she makes that cross on the bridge to address the, right?
You know, yeah.
That's always the iconic.
Exactly. But everybody knows, if you just look at that one scene, who the lead is, who the most powerful person there is, and what's going on, without having to know the story. Yeah. But that's due to the set, the costumes, the lights, all the technical elements of it. And I think it's funny what you said, if you want to like learn blocking, like be, or storytelling or anything, be a crew person.
Mm-hmm.
You know how many times backstage we're like, but why does that doesn't even make any sense, like this time period doesn't work and they just contradicted themselves, and why is this person even in the show? And because after you've watched it 15 times and you're doing the same thing over and over, you can start pulling things apart and being like, this doesn't make sense, and there's a plot hole right here and all that. And because what else would you say you're doing when you're watching the show over and over and over besides pull it apart?
This is kind of tangential, but you know, one of my favorite memories, kind of working, and it was Fall Spot on a Penn and Teller show. They did a quick like 2 week, flash production, and you know, the gap between the two show days was kind of short, so they catered our lunch, and it was like the lunches were, you know, all kind of laid out, and so Penn and Teller would come in, you know, Penn would come in his boxers, grab his sandwich, and go back to his dressing room. Teller would come out, and Teller, you know, A, was a brilliant guy, just as brilliant as you expect him to be.
Nice.
And also, he also kind of knew, like, you know, A, the crew were the people who were saving his ass and making them look good. And B, we were all more than what we'd expect we would be. So, I mean, I will never forget. I mean, I'm sitting there with Teller, and we're having this kind of really interesting introspective. I can't remember what play we were talking about. But we had this really introspective conversation about Shakespeare, which made me really bummed that I missed his Tempest that came through a couple of years ago. Because I just remember that conversation with him, and just how nuanced and how thoughtful and how, you know, how his theories and feelings about magic and how sleight of hand works, you know, are very much about storytelling, right? Like, like sleight of hand is storytelling. There are, you know, there are 5 points in a story, and there are seven points in sleight of hand, and it's they are similar, and they lend you know, there's a relationship to that, which is
interesting. I never thought about that. But yeah, you got to draw the audience attention to one side to do a trick on this side, and then there's usually a follow up thing. And...
Well, it's that presentation is okay. What, you know. If you think in a five point story arc, it's like, well, who's the character? So what's the thing I'm focusing on? I'm focusing on this coin. And then your next point of story is, what do they want? It's like, well, what are we expecting this coin to do, right? And then what is our antagonist, or what are we up against? Now, what is the subversion of you know, now the coin is disappearing or whatever like that. And then you have the climax of, you know, of the opposition and the hero facing off one another. And now we have the basically kind of the prestige where, you know, we don't know what's going to happen next. And then, you know, in magic, it's the final presentation of, well, the coin's coming out of your ear versus the resolution of the story. So they mirror each other, right?
That's very interesting. Yeah. I never thought about
that. Yeah. Great conversation.
Yeah.
That's the end of this week's podcast. Stay tuned next week for Andy Lowe, podcast number 2. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Twins Talk Theater. If you would like more, please visit our website at twinstalktheater.podbean.com or on Facebook at Twins Talk Theater. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Google Play Music. Also, give us a review on iTunes and tell us what you liked about the show.